Okay, this is speaking with Sir Fred Hoyle at Bologna on 22 May 1988.
Well, let me start by asking you.
Well, my work during the war was to basically write software for the instruments that already existed. But my first problem when I arrived there, down on the English south coast, in 1940 was to use equipment that had already been designed and fitted to solve a problem for which it was not originally designed. I mean, in other words, to find out ways of using what already existed. We were never in the position that we were able to design equipment to suit ourselves. We had to use what had been decided upon for other reasons.
What do you mean by software now?
Well, I'll give you the example. We had equipment that really was quite excellent for detecting enemy aircraft coming in to attack ships, detecting them at an early giving early warning at great range. That worked so well that even though it had been designed about 1938, it continued right through to 1945. But
this is the chain home system are you talking about?
It's a long wave detector. It turns out that long waves had very little losses. The receivers were good, and they could get a lot of power out. And so this was an excellent system. Indeed, they used to say that if that system ever went out for any reason, became unserviceable, the whole ship would become nervy from the captain downwards, right to the last rating. By the end of the war, that was the situation. Now, but unfortunately, that set wouldn't give the height of the incoming aircraft. So when they got to the point that they had ships that could carry interception aircraft, it became a very crucial matter to be able to know in advance what the height of the incoming enemy aircraft were, heights were. And I was asked when I arrived there, was there any way in which this equipment could be used, together with some simple ready reckoner for the radar officer, whereby he could judge what the height would be? Well, I soon found that there was a way to do this, that you could, from basically the range of detection, infer the height. There were some problems in that it demanded a knowledge of the efficiency of the equipment. And naturally, that efficiency was variable from one ship to another, according to the quality of the electronic components and the quality of the officers that were looking after it. So then I devised a system of automatic calibration so that they could calibrate at their leisure and then use their calibration, as it were, and so that system was used from about 1941 to 1945 everywhere. So that was my first problem.
So that's an example. It's really more procedures.
Well, then also they were anything that was basically insoluble used to land on my desk, and then I used to shove it under Bondi's desk. One problem that was that was so intractable that it led to disagreements both in the German general's staff and in the Allied general staff, and that was the problem of what you call chaff.
Yeah, and whether it should be
whether it should be used or not. With both sides. Well, it must have been about 1943 that this first got onto my desk. Was there any way in which we could distinguish aircraft among the chaff? As it happened, we solved that problem more by chance than designed. And the solution we used was the one that was employed in all post-war radar, both I suppose Russian and Allied and American. It was our solution for a long time, until it became possible to get power oscillators that would will be sufficiently frequency stable. I mean, the problem with a big power emitter.
So this is continuing after an interruption.
It was that we began when we were using high frequencies as they were then, to say about 10 centimeter wavelength.
Right.
To get very strange reports on the behavior of aircraft. And we decided we'd better look in detail at the way aircraft reflected the radar signal. And to do this, we had to look at individual pulses. Previously, you had pulses, you just didn't look at what happened from pulse to pulse. So we made our own equipment, at least Tommy Gold made it, and we then began to examine by photographic technique individual pulses. And we discovered that things can change from one pulse to the next in a most drastic way. And instantly, almost instantly, we saw from that that if we could remember the signal from one pulse to the next and make a subtraction, we would be left with something from an aircraft.
Right.
And whereas the chaff will be steady.
Right.
And therefore, by a subtraction technique, we could we could overcome the problem. And that was the method used for a very long time. And this sprang out of a discovery that was just there for another purpose. And of course, it became instantly super secret and so forth. But at that time, there was no electronic means of remembering a signal for a 500th of a second. We had to use basically analog computers, converting it into sound and then back again from sound with crystals and so forth.
I see.
So that was.
So these are the kinds of things that you were working on.
That's that kind of thing.
Now, let me ask you, when did you first become aware of radio astronomy and did it influence anything you did during the war?
It didn't influence anything I did during the war, but I became aware of it probably earlier than either Ryle or Lovell, and that was because Edward Appleton, who was a sort of very senior scientist, realized that the work that was being done in different services was very uncorrelated, and so he formed what was called a propagation committee.
I'm familiar with that committee.
Yeah,
right.
And so I was a member of it, and there were two Admiralty members, I was one of them, and J.S. Hay was there, and so Hay told me all about his early things, sort of over lunch.
Can you remember if you learned about them in 1942 when he had his first report, or was it only at the end of the war when he...
Oh no, it was during the war. It was during the war, at the time he made them.
Okay, so you remember hearing about it when he first made them in 1942.
Yes, he would tell me when he made his first discovery on the sun, he told me straight away. And when he first found a discrete source, he told me.
And how did that strike you at that time, as being very plausible, or did you feel like it was well...
I didn't think it. It never occurred to me there was anything wrong with what he was doing, because I felt he was a trustworthy person.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one reason. In fact, we had all sorts of discussions as to how we would make antenna systems and so on, if we got a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Gold had the idea that subsequently became Arecibo.
The spherical dish.
Using the contour of the land.
Right.
And we wonder whether that might be a possible way to do it. And so all those things were going on before 1945.
Right.
But after 1945, as I told you, we never had the opportunity because Cambridge was our university and Radcliffe invited Ryle in there. So that may have been responsible for, as I said, for the tensions.
So you would have liked to have gone on with radio astronomy research yourself?
Oh, absolutely. But but it became a question that had we changed university, which we just didn't think of seriously at all, it might have been a problem of getting money.
Yeah.
One needed a powerful backing. And basically, Radcliffe chose to import Ryle rather than use the people who were around. I couldn't have helped because I was a theoretician, a mathematician, so was Bundy and Wynne. So you could say the decision that Cambridge made was right. They would have had to rely on Gold almost entirely. But probably that started the tension between Gold and Ryle, I've always thought. Then when Gold left in 1956.
And Gold had his
problems with Radcliffe also in terms of the Cavendish, and he finally left the Cavendish for
That's right. So, but the reason he had problems with Radcliffe is because Radcliffe brought in Riley. He wouldn't have had the problems if they'd gone ahead. See, now, my connections with the Cavendish have been very close, but on the nuclear side.
Mm-hmm.
So Radcliffe was a sort of almost an outsider in the Cavendish before the war. I mean, he was just a very isolated, tiny, small group.
Right.
But after the war, it became a much more powerful
section. And the nuclear began to fade.
And Radcliffe would have seen me as one of the nuclear people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, I made great friends with Jack Radcliffe in years afterwards, when he was retired, and we were members of the similar committee and so forth. But we weren't at that time.
Right. Well, tell me about in the late 40s. I know you were interested in the Sun. Of course, you wrote that small book about the Sun, which had a whole chapter on the Radio Sun. So you obviously were following these things with interest. I know that at the Kapitza Club, that there were lively conversations to do with these things. How did you see the field developing?
I almost certainly in those years overweighted the importance of the Sun. But there was a certain moment when I realized that what was going to happen on the radio side was going to parallel what had happened on the optical side. A lot of apparently interesting phenomena, but one didn't improve one's understanding of it very much. And that one had to step from the Sun. I mean, it looked sensible to begin with, to start with the object that's nearest to the Sun. And so I was very interested in the sort of 45, 46, 47 in the Sun. But at some point I must have seen that this was going to become more and more arid. And by 1950, I suppose, I was beginning to, about the time of Massey's conference, the Boyd conference in London. We were beginning to think extragalactically, as the discussion showed.
And the discrete sources were well, but then, of course, they were clear
We made the spring, theoretically, to Gold and I, too. Gold was always more ready to speak at large conferences than I was. I think entirely due to the fact that from the age of about that age, my hearing wasn't good enough to take part in a large group.
I see.
So you were reluctant to concentrate on listening to what's happening, and you don't have. If we're in a seminar room, you find I was interjecting and so on all the time. Where it's easier to keep pace with what's going on. I'm on the mob, then. But in a big conference hall, so if you read the reports, you'll find that Tommy makes more of the interjections than I did. But
you did give a talk at that conference. And you never made a lot of
connectivity problems, I think.
Right. No. You never made a lot of comments about the radio stars, but at one point you said, I fully agree with Gold,
Well, we had talked about it. And we made the jump to thinking that things were extra good. But in part, I must say, in my own mind, I would have to say that what my discussions with Hay have played a role in that.
I see.
Because Hay was never... he did notice that the Cygnus source that he found was is along the plane of the galaxy.
Right.
So one has a...
It was confusing with that Cygnus X, as it was called.
Ionized
hydrogen complex.
Yeah. So it was confused for a long time.
But how did the discussions with Hay influence you?
Well, I suppose in a new phenomenon, I like to bracket the possibilities. I do a wide grid of possibilities. And then as the observations come along, I sort of narrow the grid into a certain area. And at that time, we had a very wide grid and of possibilities. And I suppose over the 5 years between Hay and Massey's conference, I've been moving slowly towards the extragalactic part.
But now, I think from reading the proceedings of that conference, it seems that it was not so much that you, or at least Gold, believed they were extragalactic. He said, we just can't rule that out.
That's right. Had this grid of possibilities. But as soon as we began to see that there were two kinds of sources, it must have been about that time that we began to realize that there was an isotropic component.
Right. The 1C survey, 50 stars, they were isotropic.
as we said, that either means they're very close right. or they're very far. And I think I could reasonably claim that at that time I knew more about stars than the radio astronomers did. Right. And I was very skeptical. It was the same argument I was having about quasars with Martin Schmidt. Only 4 months, I sat in Schmidt's office in December 1962. And he and Sandage were claiming that the quasars were local, like the radio stars. And I said, Martin, I don't believe it. I think that they are very massive objects far out. And that has never been admitted. Right. But you know there's a lot of ill feeling about the early days of the quasars.
Well, let's try to go along chronologically. We'll maybe hopefully get to that.
Well, that's another matter.
So I think what... Is it correct that what bothered you mostly was the almost dogmatism in which there was stating that here is a population of radio stars and the extragalactic idea wasn't being considered at all by Ryle?
That's right. It's a matter of temperament. You have it in the quasar thing now that the whole astronomical world believes that these things are at great distances, despite the fact that when you do, are reasons for believing mm-hmm. in big distances. Classical reasons is the Hubble diagram, and when you put the quasars on the Hubble diagram, yeah. they do not indicate any distance effect. So I find it no difficulty in keeping an open mind. Whereas it seems to be with most scientists, they
need a consensus.
There's a religious drive in them to have a compulsion to believe something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas I don't have that at all.
Yes.
If you say, well, let's discuss this possibility, then we'll discuss that possibility, or discuss this one.
Yeah.
I find no difficulty in keeping an open mind about things.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's just talk a little bit about the genesis of the steady state theory. Was that at all influenced by the new radio astronomy?
No, not at all.
I've never heard that it was.
My case, anyway.
Right. No, I've never heard that it was.
No, the story there is that you heard what Hermann said. It was pretty accurate what he said. We three of us, I actually had a house deep in the countryside, and in winter it became very inconvenient to, there were no buses or trains to get home, so I used to stay in college in the week and go home on the weekends. And one evening we went to the cinema, and it must have been in 1946, I think, and there was a picture that eventually became very famous called The Dead of Night, and it was a circular film. It was in four components. And it was one of these sleeper films that later became very famous. Hmm. But it was re-entrant, it went through a series of events and connected with its beginning.
Huh.
And when we got back to Bondi's rooms, Tommy said wouldn't it be interesting if the universe was like that? And anyway, we didn't take this seriously for a day or two. And actually, Hermann had been going through Robertson's article in the Reviews of Modern Physics, and I would frequently discuss the relativity with him, and by this time I'd understood the cosmological connections with general relativity and so forth. We were both very clear about it all, and so we began to think about it rather seriously. But we saw pretty well that there had to be a creation phase involved.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, they ducked away from this. They didn't like it. And I dropped it for almost a year until a number of events like... I was talking about the origin of the elements. Incidentally, the elements didn't... The work on chemical elements did not come from the cosmology. This is totally wrongly reported. It was an independent line of investigation, and you could say the cosmology to some extent came from the elements, because I gave a talk to the Physical Society in Birmingham.
You're referring to what Hermann Bondi said yesterday in his talk, that...
That it sprung out of...
Right.
Many people believe that, but that's to set the arrow of causality the wrong way.
I see. Well, please tell me about that, yeah.
Well, I had continued to sort of develop the ideas on elements in stars, and the Physical Society held a meeting in Birmingham, and my old supervisor, Rudolf Piles, asked during the questions, he said, Piles believed that the elements came from neutron aggregates, huge neutron aggregates. So he was, to some extent, he was hostile to what I'd said. And he, as a sort of furious criticism, he said, if you start asking where the elements came from, and you say they came from hydrogen, at some point, at some point...
Could you say that again? What did Pyle say?
He said, if you start imagining the elements came from hydrogen, at some point you have to say, where does the hydrogen come from? You'll find in the recorded thing afterwards, it's in there, in the publications of the Physical Society. And I wondered about this on the way home. I had a very cold drive in a very old car, and I wondered about this. And this must have been November 47.
Yes.
And I wondered more and more and more, and through the following few weeks, we finished our teaching in Cambridge, and I then got into the Christmas vacation. And it was during that Christmas vacation that I had the idea of coupling a scalar field to gravity.
I see.
And at the toward the end of January, I found what Van Hove said in his lecture, that as soon as you do that, an inflationary phase is inevitable. In other words, I got the disintometric, I got the solution. I wrote the thing up in February of 58.
And
gave a talk on it on the Cavendish on March 1st. I still remember the day because both Dirac and Heisenberg were there. And Heisenberg subsequently reported, when he got back to Germany, this idea of coupling a scalar field to gravity was one of the more interesting things he'd heard during his 6 months in England. But that might be some personal aspect, because Heisenberg had been invited by my college and I knew him pretty well.
Right.
So, then, as Herman said yesterday, I showed them that before I sent it to a journal. I actually sent it to the Proceedings of the Physical Society. They returned it after about 6 weeks with a letter, not rejecting it, but suggesting I sent it to the Royal Astronomical Society. But the problem was that the RAS had just printed one of my papers, and it had taken nearly 2 years.
They had tremendous delays. That time. There was a paper shortage.
It wasn't viciousness. Yeah. And I thought, I then sent it to the Physical Review, and I got a reply again, not rejecting it, but saying that it should be shortened to about half the length. And I was worried that it wasn't a very long paper. I was worried it would become meaningless, so then I sent it to the RAS. So owing to these two events, I wasn't thinking about priority at all, otherwise I would have behaved differently. Meanwhile, Bondi and Golder got back to it from their more philosophical point of view and written their paper, and they sent it straight to the RAS. So owing to this sort of way the papers were dealt with, theirs appeared just slightly ahead of mine.
Right.
That's what happened. The history of the priority in that theory is very complicated. The first concept that there might be that kind of thing came from Gold. They dropped it. We all dropped it. I returned to it, possibly due to Pyle's remark.
But then when you returned to it, why did it not become a three-way thing at that point?
Because they were still interested in cosmology, and they were trying, as I remember, an electrical model. I seem to remember arguing with Bondi towards the end of December 47, in which he was saying he preferred a kind of electrostatic effect, which subsequently he did something rather like that with Littleton in the late 50s.
Oh yes, that's right.
So that he had that sort of idea. And if he said, oh yes, let's get down to this, then I think it would have happened that way. Uh-huh. He's always said, and quite correctly, it was a bad mistake that we didn't all get together, but I don't think that was my fault. I think it was the circumstance that they were trying a different possibility. And then when they saw my result, they saw it was better to go that way.
Right. And what was your attitude at that time?
Cappuccino.
What was your attitude at that time? that this was something that could solve the age problem primarily, or was it the intrinsic, you know, the perfect cosmological principle being superior to the cosmological? I mean, what was the real attraction
Bundy,
for you?
Bundy made a lot of fuss about the age problem yesterday. But I think I can say with my hand on my heart, I've never been excited about that problem. I gladly accepted that it might solve the age problem, but again, I think I could reasonably say I knew enough about stellar structure not to to feel that the universe just had to be older.
Right.
And he mentioned Arthur Holmes. So I had no great faith in Hubble's value.
Right. So what was really the attraction for you? Was it just nice to have another model?
The real attraction to me is what has now emerged from modern cosmology. They now say that, as I say, Van Hove said, if you couple a scalar field to gravity, a de Sitter-metric is that kind of steady solution is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
This is understood now. But I found, however I did it, I tried several ways, I always got the same result. And so I stumbled on what is now known to the modern particle physicist. And I think that mathematical discovery was the thing that that motivated me.
You lost the freedom of choice as to metric.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. It just drove you to that metric.
And it wasn't anything to do with not liking the idea that there was a beginning at some time.
That has to be a component. Yes, I have never liked the idea of a finite of a beginning. I should have done because I was reared in a sort of Christian background. I mean, my parents weren't religious, but. It went on all around, and all the kids went to church and so forth.
What,
so.
Anglican?
Hmm?
Anglican?
Yes, Anglican. And in fact, you could say the same with Bundy and Gold. I mean, it's Judaic Christian belief in an origin, but,
right.
But they weren't. So it was rather odd. That, mm-hmm. But I think Greek culture sort of, I think, played a role in this. I had more of a feeling, although I wasn't conscious of it, that I didn't like the idea of the one God sort of.
You had more sympathy with the Greek kind of approach. You weren't influenced at all by Oriental.
I wasn't at that point influenced by Oriental things, but I was. I think I had a sort of more of a feeling. Of course, I knew about the Greek mathematicians and so on, so I had an admiration for their culture. And I think I've always had a feeling that their religion was more likely to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a literal sense, but their... And you can see that the population at large divides into two groups on this matter. In the Western world, the idea of a sudden beginning is fairly popular, but there are people who just can't accept it. If I go to India, then nobody will accept it.
Yeah.
I mean, they just don't like the concept at all.
Let me ask more generally, as the debates swirled on through the 50s, and did you ever notice any component of belief that was of a non-scientific sort, where a person's religion seemed to be determining somewhat the kinds of arguments they were making,